Sweet in the morning. Oh Lord, it's sweet in the morning.
Hello, this is CPR Metro. My name is Bernard White, and the name of this program is Wake Up Call. And I want to welcome you to this edition of Wake Up Call.
Sweet in the morning, 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 sweet in the morning.
As you probably know, there were some important elections that were held in states and cities across the country. Today, we'll take a close look at the results of some of these elections and what are the implications for the Trump presidency. Stay tuned.
Sweet in the morning.
All right,
right, ladies and gentlemen, that was Lauryn Hill, X Factor. So today, right in about a week, it will be a year since Donald Trump was elected the 45th president of the United States of America, and it's appropriate to look back at that year and find out what his major accomplishments are, where he's grown and where he is not. I think it's fair to say that anybody who said that he had accomplished a lot would be stretching the truth. Well, let's just call it a lie. He has no major accomplishments to his name to mention, even though he has an overwhelming majority in the Congress and the Senate. He has not even been able to carve out a cohesive enough message to get Republicans to get in line behind him. He failed in his Muslim ban 3 times. He failed in his ability to kind of repeal affordable health care a couple times. He has failed just consistently. I think his only... what he's been able to do is sign executive orders, basically repealing everything that Obama has done. He is obsessed with overturning Obama's legacy. Last time I saw somebody that obsessed with a black man, it was a Kardashian, and he's not even pregnant. So I think it's fair to look back and to see what people have done. And if you're a leader, you can tell where you start and where you finish. I defy you to tell me if his temperament is any different now than it was at the beginning. Where has he shown any demonstrative growth in temperament, in attitude, in ability, in deftness, and even the grasping of the job? He is more aloof, more unpopular. Even his supporter, as rock solid as they are eroding. Apparently now the people in the Rust Belt and the South of the Red States are now realizing that all those factories and coal mines that he promised you aren't coming back. That wall isn't getting built. You're not going to be any safer. That extreme vetting for Muslims you would never do for white guys who stockpile assault weapons and rounds of ammunition. If you have a Muslim name, if you use a Muslim name, you're actually it's actually more dangerous to have be a white dude with three names using three names than it is to be a Muslim using your three names. In America, are we any better off? The question that anybody asks after a year, after a certain period of time, are you better off than you were before? And I would say, submit to you, if you're very rich, yes. The stock market is booming. Yet the jobless, job rate, the unemployment rate is lower, like it was trending anyway. But are you personally better off? Do you feel better about the country? Do you feel better about how things are going? I read a study recently where white people actually feel like they've been discriminated against. That white people feel like they the niggas now. So I don't think anybody can fairly say anybody except very rich people can say that things are demonstrably better for them. Internationally, where are we? Are we better as a nation? Are race relations better? So far, you fought with, Gold Star wives and families. You have tried to ban the LGBT community and transgenders. You have tried to roll back, advancements that we've made in terms of the prison pipeline and mandatory sentencing, marijuana. You try to repeal those laws. You've done everything to roll us back. If you're a Trump supporter, you don't need more elected officials. What you need is a time machine. You need to be able to go back to the 50s. If you believe that things are better or you want the country back the way it was, you need a time machine. And it's said that the very people who need the time machine are the least people likely to be able to create one. You can't even start your deuce in the quarter. How the hell are you going to get a DeLorean to go back in time? Are we better off than we were before? All these promises, did he shake things up? Did you get what you were promised? Is it billed as advertised? I think that's the mark. And I think when you get, I don't know what you get in the first year of any anniversary, but the first thing we should get him as a president is competence. The basic ability to do the job he promised to do. Is he ain't? All right, that's a little note from the GED section. We got the Jazz Report coming up in 15 minutes. It's the DLU.
It's the Real News. I'm Aaron Maté. Democrats scored big victories on Election Day in what was widely seen as a rebuke of President Donald Trump. But these wins also have significance for the ongoing internal debate over the party's future. Democratic Socialist candidates were among the key winners, and candidates backed by the Bernie Sanders offshoot, Our Revolution, won 21 out of the 59 contests they took part in. This election day comes as a new book from former DNC chair Donna Brazile has reignited the tensions between supporters of Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Last week, Brazile revealed a financial arrangement that gave the Clinton campaign effective control of the DNC well before Clinton won the nomination. Speaking today on MSNBC, Brazile called the Clinton camp a cult.
It was a cult. I felt like it was a cult. You could not penetrate them. I mean, I'm a grassroots organizer. I know street politics better than I know sweet politics. I know how to touch people where they live, work, play, and pray. But I cannot help a candidate, Joe, if I don't have the resources, if I cannot spend the resources that the party is raising, because there's a blind agreement between a campaign.
Unspoken even.
Yeah. And again, I want my party to come back from this stronger.
Brazile's open criticism of the Democratic Party coincides with a recent autopsy of the Democrats put together by a group of progressives. It's called Autopsy, the Democratic Party in Crisis. And I'm joined now by a member of the group that put it out. Jeff Cohen is an author and founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he's also an associate professor of journalism and the co-founder of the group RootsAction.org. Welcome, Jeff. Before we get to the autopsy, I'm curious your reaction to the election day results. A lot of progressive victories. A transgender woman beat the state lawmaker in Virginia who introduced the bathroom bill. In Philadelphia, we have a civil rights attorney who is opposed to mass incarceration now becoming the new district attorney. Your sense of what happened on Tuesday across the country?
New district attorney in Philadelphia. Yeah, it's a good day for progressives. This was a big win. It showed that you could defeat Trumpism. And one of the most delightful victories, you alluded to it, is this young socialist who's now a member of the State House in Virginia named Lee Carter. And there's a wonderful article about him in the New Republic. He's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. He's 30 years old. His campaign manager was 22. And they didn't get much help from the state party in Virginia, and they won. So there's a lot of excitement. But the caveat is that if you keep a corporate establishment with a stranglehold over the National Democratic Party, the neoliberal hawkish wing of the Democratic Party, then a lot of this energy that showed itself so well across the country on Tuesday, it will not be able to win big elections. It will not be able to win enough big elections. That's the problem.
Let's talk about that in terms of your autopsy. The report goes through a number of issues with the party. And the first one at the very top is corporate power in the party. What did you find?
Well, the party cannot appeal to working class voters as well as it should across racial lines if it's seen as tied to corporate power. Just think, for 16 years, Democrats were in the White House, first Bill Clinton and then Barack Obama, and never once during a time of mass outsourcing of jobs, middle class union jobs outsourced to cheap labor, slave labor countries. And not once in that 16 years did a Democratic Party president polarize with one of those outsourcing corporations. Indeed, Barack Obama made the head of his jobs council the CEO of General Electric, which was a pioneer in outsourcing. So if you are sort of tied to corporate power so you can't identify villains, comes along Trump, and he's not the only one, but phony populists, charlatans, seeming to stand up against the rich or against the big corporations that the Democratic leadership will not stand up against, that charlatan may get elected. And, Trump got elected in 2016. I'm worried about future Trumps if the Democratic Party leadership is controlled by Wall Street and a corporate elite that does not allow a progressive populist agenda to be heard, that could appeal to working class people across racial lines. You know, we pointed out in the autopsy that even the most reliable core in the base of the Democratic Party, the core group, is African-American women. And even there, they're losing faith. And surveys are showing a higher percentage, a stronger minority of African-American women who say, neither party represents me. So, yes, corporate power is a key reason that the Democratic Party agenda does not appeal to working class people in the way that it could.
Right. You know, if I remember the figure right from your report, overall, the African-American vote declined 7% from 2012 to 2016. And one of the things I found interesting was where you quote someone named Albert Morales, who was the Democratic National Committee's Director of Engagement for Latino Voters. And he asked for $3 million to battle voter suppression in a number of key states. $3 million was his request. And in response to his request, he got just $300,000, which he says was a pitiful amount.
Yeah, and that happened. He made his request in 2014. In 2016, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus complained there's not enough outreach. You've had African-American leaders, Amy Allison, Steve Phillips from Democracy in Color, making the same complaint that there wasn't enough door knocking and mobilizing in the African-American community in 2016. And that's part of the critique that anyone can find if they read our report at democraticautopsy.org, which is the agenda is wrong. The agenda is not progressive. The agenda is not anti-corporate. The agenda is not pro-working class and pro-jobs. But also the outreach, the way the Democratic Party operates. It's run by a bunch of well-off white people. They hire well-off white consultants, and they are out of touch with working class people. They're out of touch with people of color. And the best example of what went wrong in 2016, and we quote it in our report, is the now infamous quote from the Democratic leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, who said in July of 2016, for every blue-collar Democrat we lose in Western Pennsylvania, we will pick up two moderate Republicans in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And you can repeat that in Ohio and Illinois and Wisconsin, unquote. That says it all. It's like, yeah, we can have our agenda tied to Wall Street and corporate elite and support NAFTA and support Trans-Pacific Partnership. And sure, we will lose working class voters in Ohio and Wisconsin and Michigan, but we're going to pick up the, quote, persuadables, the moderate Republicans. And if you pay a lot of money to multimillionaire consultants who get rich in every election cycle, but they often cannot win because they are so out of touch with working class voters, then you'll be looking for these few persuadable Republicans when the real job is appeal to young people, appeal to black people, appeal to Latinos, and mobilize them to get out to vote. That's the way to win elections behind a progressive change of our country, not relying on the formulation of Chuck Schumer. And the best example of how the Clintonites who ran the DNC are out of touch is when Trump is giving his slogan, Make America Great Again, hearkening to some distant past that never was. There was actually for a while on the website of the Clinton campaign, America is already great, unquote. That's how they were going to rebut Trump's Make America Great Again. Well, in a change election with massive income inequality, where people are hurting in all of these swing states, working people of all colors, and your slogan is America is already great. I think it only lasted a few hours, but these are highly paid consultants, totally divorced from middle class and working class and poor America.
Right. You know, one of the gems that come out of the book Shattered, which came out a few months ago, it's an inside story of the Clinton campaign based on interviews with dozens of campaign staffers. The authors reveal that the Clinton campaign approach to Michigan was to simply avoid it because they realized that Hillary Clinton's message was turning off working class voters because of her stance on trade. So their novel approach was simply to stop campaigning in Michigan in the hopes that they would turn out the people who already were in favor of Clinton and just not spark any more opposition to her than already existed. And we all know how that turned out. Let me ask you, Jeff. So essentially, your autopsy here is an endorsement of sorts for this civil war inside the party of the Bernie Sanders wing advancing with its message and doing away with the corporate Democratic message. But the problem with the civil war right now is that the Clinton wing and the Sanders wing are not the only two sides. We're also dealing with the Trump presidency and the Republicans. So I'm wondering your thoughts on dealing with the struggles of trying to reform the party while still needing coalitions, still needing to make coalitions sometimes with corporate Democrats to stop the Trump agenda.
Yeah, it's a good question, but let me take issue with one of its assumptions. The DemocraticAutopsy.org, our report is not aimed at refighting 2016 or worsening a divide within the Democratic Party. The goal of the autopsy, and, you know, I'm passionate, but the autopsy is very sober, and I encourage everyone to read it. It's about 33 pages. It's very sober, and it's talking about the future and looking at the past for what was done wrong and what needs to be done in the future. And yes, the number one enemy is Trumpism and the racism and the xenophobia of it. Number one enemy, no doubt about it. But it's our argument in the autopsy that unless you have a different agenda, a progressive agenda, public college free, universal health care, jobs programs, green jobs programs that can put people to work, unless you have that agenda combined with a strategy of reaching out to your base, you know, people under 30 are the most progressive force in society. Reach out to young people, reach out to people of color, reach out to working class people with a message that will create enthusiasm. That's the way to defeat Trumpism. You will not defeat Trump if you run people like Dianne Feinstein. If you elect people who get elected on a neoliberal, corporate-friendly, hawkish politics, it will just lead to this seesaw where 2 years later, the Republicans will win again. You know, we've been there before. We had Bill Clinton with a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate in 1993, and they vacillated. They passed NAFTA. They alienated their base, and the Republicans came flooding into power. Obama gets elected in 2009. We have a majority of the Democrats in the House, a majority of the Senate is Democrat, and then because they helped out Wall Street, but they wouldn't put a foreclosure freeze to save millions of homes, they lost everything again. So, yes, Aaron, you're right. The number one goal is we have to turn back Trumpism. But you cannot turn back Trumpism by just bringing back a new batch of neoliberal corporate Democrats, because trust me, they will lose 2 years later. You need a transformed Democratic Party in order to actually defeat Trumpism and build a progressive future that can hold on to power and deliver enough reforms for the working class of all races so that you stay in power.
And transforming the Democratic Party, to me, sounds not like necessarily relitigating the 2016 primary, but, you know, deciding on and debating the future of the party based on the split that that primary brought out.
I agree with that, but we're not going in the right direction. You know, a few weeks ago, there was a Democratic Party meeting in Las Vegas, and Tom Perez, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, engaged in a purge where several of the pro-Bernie people, including the wonderful, very loyal Democrat Arab American leader James Zogby, he was kicked off of two committees he'd been on for years. So, no, I would say that Tom Perez and the National Democratic party leadership is going in the wrong direction. But the exciting thing and on Tuesday is that the base is what made this victory possible. These people that have won elections across the country, many of whom supported Bernie, some of whom did not, but many of them are running for the first time. A lot of people of color, a lot of women. We had queer candidates. We had trans candidates. We had open socialist candidates. If the energy comes from the base, then we can push Tom Perez and the neoliberals aside over time. And I believe it's the only way to defeat Trumpism. Neoliberal corporatists, maybe they'll win this election or that, but it's not a prolonged, permanent way of defeating the Trumps and building a progressive future. That has to come from transforming the Democratic Party from the ground up. And Tuesday was a good start on that.
Jeff Cohen, co-founder of RootsAction.org and founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, where he's also an associate professor of journalism. The Democratic Autopsy is at democraticautopsy.org. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks, Aaron.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
Ralph Northam's victory in Virginia last night wasn't the extent of the beating that the Republicans took there. It also took place in the legislature as well. Before the election, Republicans enjoyed a 66-34 supermajority in the House of Delegates. Democrats picked up 15 of the 17 seats that they would need to flip that over. Three seats, all currently held by Republicans, are currently too close to call. And I believe since we made that graphic, I think one more seat went to the Democrats. So there's still no guarantee these are too close to call whether it might flip, but it still might at this point. Regardless, even if the rest go to Republicans, this is the largest Democratic gain in a single election in the state since 1899.
That's more than two centuries ago.
That's a long time. That's a long time
ago. Last century was the 20th century. The one before that was the 19th century. That was the 19th.
It's weird how that works. Now, what's interesting is that that's a big flip. You know, you don't normally see that since 1899, it looks like. But they're still perhaps going to be in the minority, even though Democratic candidates outperformed Republicans by about 9.4 percentage points. Which is significant. I mean, we are a country of 51, 52 to 48, you know, those sorts of races. When you win by almost 10 points statewide, you sort of expect that you might have control of that state's legislature, but you don't in a lot of states, and especially not in Virginia because of the gerrymandering that's been going on there and around the country for decades at this point. And that's one of the things where Northam, regardless of where he stands on the other issues, might be very significant. Because previously, you've had Republican legislatures and Republican governors to sign on to these redistricting plans that are very often racist, designed to suppress people's ability to influence politics. And it looks like that probably won't happen this next time around. Which isn't just good for Northam, it's not just good for the Democrats that won, but for anyone who seeks, you know, statewide or state legislature an election in the future in Virginia. Like, you need to have fair maps if you're going to have a chance there, and we might actually get that in the next few years.
Well, they say that the Supreme Court is going to decide on this gerrymandering thing soon. And
yeah, there's a case that in the near future could actually re-raise this.
And they're saying that it looked like this conservative court was giving favor to the people saying that gerrymandering is illegal, mm-hmm. right? And they shouldn't do it. So
that's surprising.
That is surprising,
yeah.
right? Because those guys are freaking fascists, right?
Yeah.
On the court, they don't give a shit. So, yeah, it's weird that they're doing that. So who knows? Maybe we'll get rid of gerrymandering. I know in California, didn't Arnold Schwarzenegger do a thing where we now have to draw the districts correctly?
That sounds familiar. I wasn't around for that, but that does sound familiar. There's been a few state experiments where they'll either have particular tests for how fair, you know, the map is. There's also, I think it's Arizona, maybe Nevada, that has an independent commission, a nonpartisan commission that has to go over it. I mean, the idea that you could allow the party that controls the state currently to choose what the map will be for next time, who thinks that's a good idea other than those people?
That would be it.
Yeah, and this is one of those issues that it's like a foundational issue, like money in politics, where these sorts of issues affect the outcomes we have on all of the other more specific issues. You know, like, will we be able to raise the minimum wage? That sort of thing. Well, I mean, if you have the people who are winning elections based on biased maps or because of corporate donations, that affects not just one topic, but it affects all of the topics. Which is why if you can fix these sorts of issues, if you can get money out of politics, if you can stop the gerrymandering, then that has ripple effects, like a virtuous cycle on so many other things. And this is just Virginia, but it's certainly, considering the extent of the gerrymandering here, that is good to see.
Well, and you want to talk about how we've mentioned there's some silver linings in this whole thing. One of the things that the Trump administration has done to a lot of the populace. Now, there's some people that like to pretend that everything was just hunky-dory and our democracy was flawless until Trump showed up. But a lot of people realize that's certainly not the case. It's a broken system that led us to Trump. So now people are talking about stuff like gerrymandering more than ever before. People are talking about how for the second time in less than 20 years, the popular vote winner doesn't sit in the White House. People are talking about a lot of that stuff and how all this stuff, which is just corruption, should have been gone years ago. And you're even seeing alternative voting methods on the ballot in certain states, ranked choice and stuff like that. So I think that we're recognizing that this democracy we need to spread everywhere else. We haven't really mastered it here at all and have a lot of work to do.
Yeah, so we have this sort of popular myth that things, I guess, you know, the system was fucked up, but it mostly worked for a couple hundred years. But that is a myth. Like, it was always rigged to benefit certain people, advantage them over others. We just sort of pretended that if we keep our head down, if we work hard, things will be fine. Mm-hmm. And if you were a particular sort of white person, for a long time, that might even be the case. But for a lot of Americans, it was never true, and it's certainly not true now, and people seem to be realizing that.
It's a real pleasure to introduce Chris Hedges tonight. As the reality of war becomes less precise and less visible in the American media, we need more than ever the thinking and writing of correspondents who have seen that reality for themselves. During the post-Vietnam era, the path of war has run through most of the regions of the world, and Chris Hedges has spent most of his adult life on that path bearing witness to war's results. He spent 5 years in El Salvador during the 1980s, moved on to Guatemala, Nicaragua, and Colombia, saw the first intifada on the West Bank and Gaza, the civil wars in the Sudan and Yemen, the uprisings in Algeria and the Punjab, the Gulf War of the early 1990s, the Kurdish rebellion in the region shared by Turkey and Iraq, and the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. After having spent those years filing countless reports from the front lines of these conflicts, Mr. Hedges has distilled not just the lessons, but the psychological effects of war in his remarkable book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. The numerous and laudatory reviews have acknowledged that in the swarm of war books that have appeared since 9/11, this work stands out for the profundity of both its questions and its answers. If Chris Hedges has evolved from war reporter to war philosopher, he has remained nonetheless eminently practical. He has recently published a second book called What Every Person Should Know About War. There he asks and answers such questions as, what are my chances of being wounded or killed if we go to war? What do artillery shells do to you? Will I be afraid? What will happen to my body after I die? The book is written not for opinion leaders, but for ordinary recruits who are attracted to war's images of glory and heroism, but who know little of its reality. Many of you here tonight, as I saw from the show of hands, heard Seymour Hersh speak yesterday. Well, where Hersh reports on the making of war policy, Chris Hedges has become a reporter of war culture. Mr. Hersh has asked the question, how did 8 or 9 people seize control of American foreign policy and start a war? Mr. Hedges asks a complementary and perhaps more disturbing question. Why did 80 or 90 million people support the war? Why do national majorities regularly support war? Why is it that in similar circumstances, the public will most likely support war again? For commentary on these and other pressing questions, please join me in giving a big Santa Barbara welcome for Chris Hedges.
Thank you, Chris, and thank you very much for having me tonight. I have, as Chris said, spent most of my adult life in war. I began 2 decades ago covering wars in Central America and the Middle East and the Balkans, where I covered the wars in Bosnia and Kosovo. My life has been marred, let me say deformed, by the organized industrial violence that year after year was an intimate part of my existence. I have watched young men bleed to death on lonely Central American dirt roads and cobblestone squares in Sarajevo. I have looked into the eyes of mothers, keening over the lifeless and mutilated bodies of their children. I have stood in warehouses with rows of corpses, including children, and breathed death into my lungs. I carry within me the ghosts of those I worked with, my comrades, now gone. War has found us out again. We have blundered into nations we know little about, caught between bitter rivalries between competing ethnic and religious groups, and we have embarked on an occupation in Iraq that is as damaging to our souls as it is to our prestige and power and security. We have become tyrants to others weaker than ourselves, and we believe falsely that because we have the capacity to wage war, we have the right to wage war. Once you master a people by force, you depend on force for control. Isolation always impairs judgment, and we are very isolated now. In Antigone, the king imposes his will without listening to those he rules and dooms himself. Thucydides wrote of Athens' expanding empire and how this empire led it to become a tyrant abroad and then a tyrant at home. The tyranny Athens imposed on others, it finally imposed on itself. The lust for war and the desire for profits led the Athenians to lose sight of democratic ideals, ideals that are their legacy to us and should be our legacy to others. We are fed images and slogans that perpetuate fantasies about our own invulnerability, our own might, our own goodness. And these illusions blind us. We cannot see ourselves as others see us. We had fed the heart on fantasies, William Butler Yeats wrote, the heart's grown brutal from the fair. It is 1967 in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and we have become Israel. Our empire has expanded. We have become pariahs, and we are propelled forward not by logic or compassion or understanding, but by fear. We have created and live in a world where violence has become the primary form of communication, and we have built an alliance against terror with Ariel Sharon and Vladimir Putin, two men who do not shrink from gratuitous and senseless killing in the Israeli-occupied territories and Chechnya. And those who are not with us, and few are with us now, we ridicule and belittle and condemn. We have become the company we keep. Much of the world, certainly the Muslim world, one-fifth of the world's population, most of whom, I remind you, are not Arab, see us through the prism of Iraq, Palestine, and Chechnya. And this prism is one that is igniting the dispossessed and deteriorating by the hour our security and safety. The attacks on the World Trade Center illustrate that those who oppose us, rather than coming from another moral universe, have been schooled well in modern warfare. The dramatic explosions, the fireballs, the victims plummeting to their deaths, the collapse of the towers in Manhattan were straight out of Hollywood. Where else but from the industrialized world did the suicide bombers learn that huge explosions and death above a city skyline are a peculiar and effective form of communication? They have mastered the language we taught them. They understand that the use of indiscriminate violence against innocents is a way to make a statement. And we leave the same calling cards. We delivered such incendiary messages in Vietnam, Serbia, Afghanistan, and Iraq. It was Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara who, in the summer of 1965, defined the bombing raids that would kill hundreds of thousands of civilians north of Saigon as a means of communication to the communist regime in Hanoi. The seduction of war is insidious. It appears to be a way to eradicate our enemies, to banish from the world of the living those who would do us harm. At a time when we are afraid, it gives us a false sense of power and security. Of course, we never saw the war in Iraq. The press always masks the essence of war, death, from public view. The coverage was presented as a game, as entertainment, and commentators on the cable news channels reveled in the power and might of our weaponry and, by extension, our own power. We watched neatly packaged video clips fed to the press by the war makers, and we were spared the pools of blood, the agony of the dying on the other end. It was clean and neat and tidy and wildly out of context. There was the technological capacity to show us war. We could have watched live footage of a young Iraqi soldier with his legs blown off by an anti-tank mine dying in the sand, something I saw in the Persian Gulf War. But such coverage would hardly boost ratings, hardly make us want to wage war. We were fed the myth the press almost always feeds us in wartime, and kept from seeing. There has been no more candor in Iraq or Afghanistan than there was in Vietnam, but in the age of live satellite feeds, the military has perfected the appearance of candor. For the myth of war, the myth of glory and honor, sells newspapers and boosts ratings. Real war reporting does not. Look at CNN, Fox, MSNBC. Nearly every embedded correspondent saw his or her mission as sustaining civilian and army morale. The identification of reporters with the units they cover is insipid and dangerous, but also usual. For in war, the press is always part of the problem. In wartime, as Senator Hiram Johnson reminded us in 1917, truth is the first casualty. We have lost touch with the essence of war. After our defeat in Vietnam, we became a better nation. We were humbled, even humiliated. We asked questions about ourselves we had not asked before. We were forced to see ourselves as others saw us. The site was not an attractive one. We were forced to confront our own capacity for atrocity, for evil, and in this we understood not only war, but ourselves. But this humility is gone. The good name of war has been resurrected. It began under President Reagan in Grenada and Panama and culminated in the Persian Gulf War. We have been led to believe, in the same way the doomed empires of the late 19th century believed, that our technology makes us invulnerable, a lie sadly unmasked as I speak tonight in the streets of Baghdad. War is the pornography of violence. It has a dark beauty filled with the monstrous and the grotesque. The Bible calls it the lust of the eye and warns believers against it. War gives us a distorted sense of self. It gives us meaning. It creates a feeling of comradeship that obliterates our alienation and makes us feel, for perhaps the first time in our lives, that we belong. War allows us to rise above our small stations in life. We find nobility in the cause, feelings of selflessness, even bliss. Once in a conflict, the shallowness of much of our lives becomes apparent. The fruitless search to find fulfillment in the acquisition of things and wealth and power is laid bare. The trivia that dominates our airwaves is exposed as empty chatter. War allows us to engage in lusts and passions we keep hidden in the deepest, most private interiors of our fantasy life. It allows us to destroy not only things, but human beings. In that moment of wholesale destruction, we wield the power of the divine, the power to revoke another person's charter to live on this earth. The frenzy of this destruction, and when unit discipline breaks down, or there was no unit discipline to begin with, frenzy is the right word, sees armed bands crazed by the poisonous elixir our power to bring about the obliteration of others delivers. All things, including human beings, become objects, objects to either gratify or destroy or both. Almost no one is immune. The contagion of the crowd sees to that. Force, Simonval writes, is as pitiless to the man who possesses it or thinks he does as it is to its victims. The second it crushes, the first it intoxicates. And those who have the least meaning in their lives, the impoverished Palestinian refugees in Gaza, the disenfranchised North African immigrants in France, even the legions of youth in the splendid indolence and safety of the industrialized world are all susceptible to war's appeal. I do not miss war, but I miss what it brought. I could never say I was happy in the fighting in El Salvador or Bosnia or Kosovo, but I had a sense of purpose. This is a quality war shares with love, for we are also able to choose fealty and self-sacrifice over security for those we love. This is why war, at its inception, always looks and feels like love, the chief emotion war destroys. We are tempted, maybe even encouraged, to reduce life to a simple search for happiness. Happiness, however, withers if there is no meaning. The other temptation is to disavow the search for happiness in order to be faithful to that which provides meaning. But to live only for meaning, indifferent to all happiness, makes us fanatic, self-righteous, and cold. It leaves us cut off from our own humanity and the humanity of others. The ancient Greeks understood the perverse attraction between love and death in wartime. When Achilles killed Penthesilea, the queen of the Amazons in the Trojan War, he fell in love with her as she expired on the battlefield. He murdered love, and once he murdered love, he himself was doomed. He courted death. Aphrodite, the goddess of love, had an illicit affair with Ares, the god of war. who is hated by all the other gods, with the exception of the god of the underworld, to whom he steadily brought new souls. We feel in wartime comradeship. We confuse this with friendship, with love. There are those who will insist that the comradeship of war is love, the ecstatic glow that makes us in war feel as one people, one entity, is real. But this is part of war's intoxication. Think back on the days after the attacks of 9/11. Suddenly, we no longer felt alone. We connected with strangers, even with people we did not like. We felt we belonged, that we were somehow wrapped in the embrace of the nation, the community. In short, we no longer felt alienated. As this feeling dissipated in the weeks after the attack, there was a kind of nostalgia for its warm glow. Wartime always brings with it this comradeship, which is the opposite of friendship. Friends, as J. Glenn Gray points out in his book, The Warrior's Reflections on Men in Battle, are predetermined. Friendship takes place between men and women who possess an intellectual and emotional affinity for each other. And many of us will admit that we never really had a friend, and even the most fortunate of us have very few. But comradeship, that ecstatic bliss that comes with belonging to the crowd in wartime, is within our reach. We can all have comrades. The danger, the external threat that comes when we have an enemy, does not create friendship. It creates comradeship. And those in wartime are deceived about what they are undergoing. This is why once the war ends, these comrades again become strangers to us. This is why after war, we fall into despair. In friendship, there is a deepening of our sense of self. We become, through the friend, more aware of who we are and what we are about. We find ourselves in the eyes of the friend. Friends probe and question and challenge each other to make each more complete. They draw the secrets out of us and know our inner core of being. For we reach and change others, and we ourselves are changed when we plunge to the depths of our inner life, the depths that expose our insecurities and incompleteness, those depths that often lie beyond articulation. In comradeship, the kind that comes to us in patriotic fervor, there is a suppression of self-awareness, self-knowledge, self-possession. Comrades lose their identities in wartime for the collective rush of a common cause, a common purpose. In comradeship, life is ecstatic and corporate, as opposed to friendship, where life is singular and individual. In comradeship, Gray reminds us, there are no demands on the self. This is part of its appeal, and one of the reasons we miss it and seek to recreate it. This is why once the war is over, once the danger that linked us together is past, these feelings are instantly extinguished. Sebastian Hoffner, who was a lawyer in Nazi Germany, wrote of this comradeship in his book, Define Hitler. He noted that comradeship destroys the sense of responsibility for oneself, be it civilian, or worse still, the religious sense. Comradeship always sets the cultural tone at the lowest possible level, accessible to everyone, he wrote. It cannot tolerate discussion. In the chemical solution of comradeship, discussion immediately takes on the color of whining and grumbling. It becomes a mortal sin. Comradeship admits no thoughts, just mass feelings of the most primitive sort. These, on the other hand, are inescapable. To try and evade them is to put oneself beyond the pale. In wartime, when we feel threatened, we no longer face death alone, but as a group. And this makes death easier to bear. We ennoble self-sacrifice for the other, for the comrade. In short, we begin to worship death, and this is what the God of war demands from us. Think finally of what it means to die for a friend. It is deliberate and painful. There is no ecstasy. For friends, dying is hard and bitter. The dialogue they have and cherish will perhaps never be recreated. Friends do not, the way comrades do, love death and sacrifice. To friends, the prospect of death is frightening. And this is why friendship, or let me say love, is the most potent enemy of war. We do not see war in the images of war presented in films and novels, nor in the mythic narratives the government and the press spins out for us. We never saw war in the televised images from Iraq. The war is always carefully packaged, the way tobacco or liquor companies package their own poisons. The titillation is there, but in doses we can digest. The reports give war a coherency and logic it never has in battle. We taste a bit of war's exhilaration, but are safe. War from Iraq is seen through the prism of the U.S. military, and it comes complete with manufactured heroes, feel-good stories about our own and an enemy that is always painted as barbaric and uncivilized. We can thrill in the perversity of war even as we watch films or read books that are meant to denounce war. It is almost impossible to produce anti-war films or documentaries that present images of battle. It is like trying to condemn pornography while showing erotic love scenes. The prurient fascination with violent death always overpowers the message. War is part of the modern industrial landscape. Indeed, its tools are often the cutting edge of technology. By World War I, we had created ways in which thousands of people who never saw their attackers could die in an instant. Weapons that carry out this impersonal mass slaughter are beautiful. They are crafted, sleek, and harbor within them awesome power. The machines of war, the planes, the tanks, the heavy machine guns, the huge hulking howitzers, and the helicopters are pieces of art. I have seen them at work. They are angels of death streaking through the sky. I was with a unit of guerrillas in El Salvador when some Huey helicopters raced in over a lake to hunt us down. We hid in the ruins of an abandoned village, darting from wall to wall and standing with our backs to the shattered bricks so our hunters could not see us as they passed low overhead. As I looked up at these machines that were trying to kill me, I found them seductive. Once in a conflict, once we live in the midst of fighting, we are moved from the abstract to the real, from the mythic to the sensory. No soldier after a few seconds of combat believes in the myth of war anymore. And this is why wounded Marines jeered John Wayne when he visited them in a hospital in World War II. When this move takes place, we have nothing to do with a world not at war. The world, when we return to it, is viewed from the end of a very long tunnel. There they still believe. There they do not understand. We feel different, wiser, greater. This experience is so overpowering that if we can control our fear, we go back to seek it out again. War is addictive. Indeed, it is the most potent narcotic invented by humankind. The first time I was in an ambush was in the Salvadoran town of Suchitoto. It was a dreary peasant outpost made up of stucco and mud and wattle huts off the main road. The town was surrounded by the Farabundo Marti National Liberation Front rebels, who when I arrived in El Salvador were winning the war. The government forces kept a small garrison in the town, although its relief columns were frequently ambushed as they ambled down the small strip of asphalt surrounded by high grass. It was one of the most dangerous spots in the country. The rebels launched an attack to take the town. A convoy of reporters in cars marked with TV and masking tape on the windshields hightailed it to the small bridge that led to the lonely stretch of road to Suchitoto. We stopped for the familiar ritual of getting high, something as a print reporter who could scramble to safety I did not do, but something the photographers who would stand and take pictures found a necessary balm to their nerves. Then we moved slowly down the road, the odd round fired ahead or behind us. We made it to the edge of town where we ran into rebel units, now accustomed to the follies of the press. On foot, we moved through the deserted streets. The firing from the garrison became louder as we weaved our way with rebel units to the siege that had been set up. Then, as I rounded the corner, several full bursts of automatic fire rent the air. Bullets hit the mud wall behind me. We dove into the dirt. Rebels began to fire noisy rounds from their M16 assault rifles. The scent of cordite filled the air. Rebels around me were wounded and crying out in pain. One died yelling in a sad cadence for his mother, his desperate and final plea cutting through the absurd posturing of soldiering. At first, his cries haunted me. Soon, I just wished he would be quiet. The firefight seemed to go on for an eternity. I cannot say how long I lay there. It could have been a few minutes. It could have been an hour. Here was war, real war, sensory war, not the war of the movies and novels I had consumed in my youth. It was horrifying, confusing, numbing, and nothing like the myth I had been peddled. I realized at once that it controlled me. I would never control it. In a lull, I made a dash across an empty square to find shelter behind a house. My heart was racing. Adrenaline coursed through my bloodstream. I was safe. I made it back to the capital and, like most war correspondents, soon considered the experience a great cosmic joke. I drank away the fear in a seedy bar in downtown San Salvador that night. Most people, after such an experience, would learn to stay away. I was hooked. Drawn into the world of war, it becomes hard to escape. It perverts and destroys you. It pushes you closer and closer to your own annihilation, spiritual, emotional, and finally physical. I covered the war in El Salvador from 1983 to 1988. By the end, I had a nervous twitch in my face. I was evacuated 3 times by the U.S. Embassy because of tips that the death squads planned to kill me. Yet each time I came back. I accepted with a grim fatalism that I would be killed in El Salvador. I could not articulate why I accepted my own destruction, and cannot now. There came to be a part of me, maybe it is a part in all of us, which decided I would rather die like this than go back to the dull routine. During the war in El Salvador, I worked with a photographer who covered the war, had a slew of close calls, and then called it quits. He moved to Miami and took pictures for one of the news weeklies. But life in Florida was flat, dull, and interesting. He could not adjust and soon came back. From the moment he stepped off the plane, it was clear he had returned to die. Just as there are some soldiers or war correspondents that seem to us immortal, and whose loss comes as a sobering reminder that death has no favorites, there are also those in war who are locked in a grim embrace with death from which they cannot escape. It was frightening to behold. A walking corpse. He was shot through the back in a firefight and died in less than a minute. Sigmund Freud divided the forces in human nature between the Eros instinct, the impulse within us that propels us to become close to others, to preserve and conserve, and the thanatos or death instinct, the impulse that works towards the annihilation of all living things, including ourselves. For Freud, these forces were in eternal conflict. He was therefore pessimistic about eradicating war. All human history, he argued, in civilization and its discontents, is a tug of war between these two instincts. Taste enough of war, and you come to believe the Stoics were right. We will, in the end, all consume ourselves in a vast conflagration. There is a constant search in war to find new perversities, new forms of death. When the initial flush fades, a rear guard, and finally futile effort to ward off the boredom of routine death. This is why we would drive into towns in Bosnia and find bodies crucified on the sides of barns or decapitated and mutilated. This is why those slain in combat are treated as trophies belonging to the killers, turned into grotesque pieces of performance art. I know soldiers that to this day carry in their wallets the identity cards of men they know they killed. They take them everywhere. They show them to you with the imploring look of a lost child. They will never understand. The job of killing allows our senses to command our bodies. The killing whips fighters into greater orgies of destruction, hedonism, and perversion spirals out of control. The comradeship of war actively works to stomp out all feelings of love, of tenderness, for love alone shields us. The most important part of the individual life, which cannot be subsumed in communal life, is love, Hofner wrote. So comradeship has its special weapon against love, smut. Every evening in bed after the last patrol round, there was the ritual reciting of lewd songs and jokes. That is a hard and fast rule of male comradeship. And nothing is more mistaken than the widely held opinion that this is a safety valve for frustrated erotic or sexual feelings. These songs and jokes do not have an erotic, arousing effect. On the contrary, they make the act of love appear as unappetizing as possible. They treat it like digestion and defecation and make it an object of ridicule. The men who recited rude songs and used coarse words for female body parts were in effect denying that they had ever had tender feelings or been in love, that they had ever made themselves attractive, behaved gently, and used sweet words for these same parts. They were rough, tough, and above such civilized tenderness. In war, we deform ourselves, our essence. We give up individual conscience, maybe even consciousness, for the contagion of the crowd, the rush of patriotism, the belief that we must stand together as a nation in moments of extremity. The normal order is turned upside down. Better to give yourself up to the lust of war, to make a moral choice, to defy war's enticement, to defend love, can be self-destructive. But in the rise to power, we always become smaller. Power absorbs us, and once power is obtained, we are its pawn. As in Shakespeare's Richard III, the all-powerful prince who molded the world, we fall prey to the forces we thought we had harnessed. Love may not always triumph, but it keeps us human. It offers the only chance to escape from the contagion of war. Perhaps it is the only antidote. And there are times when remaining human is the only victory possible. When the mask of war slips away and the rot and corruption is uncovered, when it turns sour and rank, when the myth is exposed as a fraud, we feel soiled and spent. It is then that we sink into despair. In the Arab-Israeli 1973 war, almost a third of all Israeli casualties were due to psychiatric causes, and the war lasted only a few days. A World War II study determined that after 60 days of continuous combat, 98% of all surviving soldiers will have become psychiatric casualties. The study found that a common trait among the 2% who were able to endure sustained combat was a predisposition towards aggressive, psychopathic personalities. During the war in El Salvador, soldiers could serve in the army for 3 or 4 years or longer, virtually until they psychologically or physically collapsed. In garrison towns, commanders banned the sale of sedatives because of the abuse by troops. In this war, the emotionally maimed were common. I once interviewed a 19-year-old Salvadoran army sergeant who had spent 5 years fighting and suddenly lost his vision after his unit walked into a rebel ambush. The rebels killed 11 soldiers in the firefight, including his closest friend. A couple dozen soldiers were wounded. He was unable to see again until he was placed in the army hospital. "I have these horrible headaches," he told me, sitting on the edge of his bed. "There is shrapnel in my head. I keep telling the doctors to take it out." But the doctors told me he had no head wounds. I saw other soldiers in other conflicts go deaf or stop speaking or simply shake without being able to stop. War is necrophilia. This necrophilia is central to soldiering just as it is central to the makeup of suicide bombers and terrorists. The necrophilia is hidden under platitudes about duty or comradeship. It waits, especially in moments when we seem to have little to live for and no hope, or in moments when the intoxication of war is at its pitch to be unleashed. When we spend long enough in war, it comes to us as a kind of release, a fatal and seductive embrace that can consummate the long flirtation with our own destruction. In Milo Vangelis' memoir of the partisan war in Yugoslavia, he wrote of the enticement death held for the combatants. He stood over the body of his comrade, the commander Sava Kovekovich, and found, "Dying did not seem terrible or unjust. This was the most extraordinary, the most exalted moment of my life. Death did not seem strange or undesirable. That I restrained myself from charging blindly into the fray and death was perhaps due to my sense of obligation to the troops or to some comrade's reminder concerning the tasks at hand. In my memory, I returned to those moments many times with the same feeling of intimacy with death and desire for it while I was in prison, especially during my first incarceration. War ascendant wipes out eros. It wipes out delicacy and tenderness. And this is why those in war swing from rank sentimentality to perversion with little in between. When we see this, when we see our addiction for what it is, when we understand ourselves and how war has perverted us, life becomes hard to bear. John Steele, a cameraman who spent years in war zones, had a nervous breakdown in a crowded Heathrow airport after returning from Sarajevo. He understood the reality of his work, a reality that stripped away the self-righteous, high-octane gloss. "I came back from Sarajevo," he said. "We were in a place called Sniper's Alley, and I filmed a girl there who had been hit in the neck by a sniper's bullet. I filmed her in the ambulance, and only after she was dead, I suddenly understood that the last thing she had seen was the reflection of the lens of the camera I was holding in front of her. This wiped me out. I grabbed the camera and started running down Sniper's Alley, filming at knee level the Bosnians, running from place to place." A year after the war in Sarajevo, I sat with Bosnian friends who had suffered horribly. A young woman, Liliana, had lost her father, a Serb, who refused to join the besieging Serb forces around the city. She had been forced a few days earlier to identify his corpse. The body was lifted, the water running out of the sides of a rotting coffin from a small park for reburial in the central cemetery. She was emigrating for Australia soon, where she told me, "I will marry a man who has never heard of this war and raise children that will be told nothing about it, nothing about the country I am from." Liliana was young, but the war had exacted a toll. Her cheeks were hollow, her hair dry and brittle, her teeth were decayed, and some had broken into jagged bits. She had no money for a dentist. She hoped to fix them in Australia. Yet, all she and her friends did that afternoon was lament the days when they lived in fear and hunger, emaciated, targeted by Serb gunners on the heights above. They did not wish back the suffering, and yet, they admitted, these may have been the fullest days of their lives. They looked at me in despair. I knew them when they were being pounded by hundreds of shells a day, when they had no water to bathe in or wash their clothes, when they huddled in unheated apartments as sniper bullets hit the walls outside. But what they expressed was real. It was the disillusionment with a sterile, futile, and empty present. Peace had again peeled back the void that the rush of war, of battle, had filled. Once again they were, as perhaps we all are, alone, no longer bound by that common sense of struggle, no longer given the opportunity to be noble, no longer sure of what life was about or what it meant. The old comradeship, however false, that allowed them to love men and women they hardly knew, indeed whom they may not have liked before the war, had vanished with a last shot. Moreover, they had seen that all the sacrifice had been for naught. They had been, as we all are in war, betrayed. The corrupt old Communist Party bosses who became nationalists overnight and got them into the mess in the first place had grown rich off their suffering and were still in power. There was a 70% unemployment rate. They depended on handouts from the international community. They understood that their cause, once as fashionable in certain intellectual circles as they were themselves, lay forgotten. No longer did actors, politicians, and artists scramble to come and visit during the ceasefires, acts that were almost always ones of gross self-promotion. They knew the lie of war, the mockery of their idealism, and struggled with their shattered illusions. And yet, they wished it all back, and I did too. A year later, I received a Christmas card. It was signed Liliana from Australia. It had no return address. I never heard from her again. But many of those I worked with as war correspondents during the past two decades did not escape. They could not break free from the dance with death. They wandered from conflict to conflict, seeking always one more hit. By then I was back in Gaza and found myself pinned down in another ambush. A young Palestinian, 15 feet away, was shot through the chest and killed. I had been lured back, but now felt none of the old rush, just fear. It was time to break free, to let go, to accept that none of this would or could or should return. I knew then that it was over. I was lucky to get out alive. Kurt Schork, brilliant, courageous, and driven, could not let go. He died in an ambush in Sierra Leone along with another friend, Miguel Gil Moreno. His entrapment, his embrace of Thanatos, of the death instinct, was never mentioned in the sterile and antiseptic memorial service staged for him in Washington. Everyone tiptoed around it, but for those of us who knew him, we understood that he had been consumed. I had worked with Kurt for 10 years, starting in northern Iraq. Literate, funny, seems the brave are often funny. He and I passed books back and forth in our struggle to make sense of the madness around us. His loss is a hole that will never be filled. His ashes were placed in the Lion's Cemetery in Sarajevo for the victims of the war. I flew to Sarajevo and met the British documentary filmmaker Dan Reed. It was an overcast November day. We stood over the grave and downed a pint of whiskey. Dan lit a candle. I recited a poem the Roman lyric poet Catullus had written to honor his dead brother. By strangers' coasts and waters, many days at sea, I come here for the rites of your unworlding, bringing for you the dead these last gifts of the living, and my words, vain sounds for the man of dust. Alas, my brother, you have been taken from me. You have been taken from me, and by cold chance turned a shadow and my pain. Here are the foods of the old ceremony, appointed long ago for the starvelings under the earth. Take them. Your brother's tears have made them wet. And take into eternity my hail and my farewell. It was there, among a few thousand war dead, that Kurt belonged. He died because he could not free himself from war. He was trying to replicate what he had found in Sarajevo, but he could not. War could never be new again. Kurt had been in East Timor and Chechnya. Sierra Leone, I was sure, meant nothing to him. Kurt and Miguel could not let go. They would be the first to admit it. Spend long enough at war, and you cannot fit in anywhere else. It finally kills you. It is not a new story. It starts out like love, but it is death. War is the beautiful young nymph in the fairy tale that, when kissed, exhales the vapors of the underworld. The ancient Greeks had a word for such a fate, ekpyrosis. It means to be consumed by a ball of fire, and they used it to describe heroes. Thank you.
Their lives in the war. They don't know just what they're fighting for. They only know that they got to kill so they'll survive. My friend, what good is the war when you can't stay alive? Shouting freedom every day. How can one be free living this way? When they want more guns to buy, they raise your income tax. And when your son come of age, they tell him, pack his sack. Mothers crying, young boys dying, hip hooray now. Save the children, stop the killing, hip hooray now, hip hooray. When you come back home to your land, as man, the leg you lost was your token to humanity. While trying to protect your life, you lost your sanity. Mothers crying.
young boys die in hip parade now. Hip parade. Save the children. Stop the killing, hip parade.